The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I'm Derek Frost for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. Today's program is generously underwritten by Brian Lee Funeral Homes, located in Raleigh, Garner, and Anger. They can be reached at 919-832-8225. They believe every life is unique and deserves to be honored so that every funeral is as unique and special as the person it represents. And we'll start with the cover story headline, The $1 Deal. Developers, designers, planners, and many others propose intriguing, affordable housing designs for Raleigh on land offered for a dollar. And the cover story begins with a second headline inside the Triangle Business Journal. Affordable housing gets creative. And this article is written by Caleb Harshberger. The city of Raleigh set off a firestorm of interest in June with its offering of a downtown lot for just $1 to go to the developer with the best plan for the land's highest and best use affordable housing. In the months since, 32 firms, nonprofits, and individuals in the Triangle and beyond have flooded the city with applications, with the narrowing of the decision to finalists now scheduled for next month. The property is made up of three parcels totaling 1.17 acres at 907 East Lane Street on a block that sits between Lane Street Mini Park and Oakwood Cemetery. Altogether, the parcels are valued at $1.45 million. That's the subsidy that we are essentially putting into the project, said Raleigh Housing and Neighborhoods Director Larry Jarvis in June. Obviously, if we were to sell it for full market value, it would be impossible for someone to make it affordable. Letters of interest poured in, with applicants running the gamut from established affordable housing developers to national engineering firms to local builders and individuals looking to get their start in the affordable housing industry. Some have teams with personal or family histories on the streets and neighborhoods around the project, while others saw it as an opportunity to launch new concepts to redefine the way affordable housing can be done in a downtown area. The RFI, released by the city, calls for proposals that seek to improve the quality of life for Raleigh's low- and moderate-income residents, with a majority of the housing units in a potential development available to residents making 80% or less of the area median income. The flood of interest caused the city staff to delay the winnowing process before sending the applications to the city council for consideration in September. The pitches include a wide variety of plans, from traditional apartments, single-family homes and apartments, to new architectural techniques using solar panels and shipping containers. Many take advantage of recent votes to allow accessory dwelling units, or ADUs, to as much as double the allowed units under the current zoning, as well as a way to help with affordability. The property is currently zoned for multifamily, cottage courts, or single-family homes with up to 10 units per acre. And while most plans do propose a development to meet the existing code, others are hoping to convince the city that their plans would be worth a change. Officials working on the project have since been restricted from commenting amid the review process. And we're going to stop there as the article goes on for three more pages chronicling each individual idea. And there's a lot of them, 32 of them. And instead, we'll turn to The Promise Of, which is the continuing series in the Triangle Business Journal. The headline, Weathering the Storms, How Warren Arrington is Positioning His MBE to Survive and Fight for New Business. And this story is written by Connie Gentry. About this project. The project name is based on an historical reference relating to Union Army leader William Sherman's promise of giving 40 acres to slaves after the Civil War. That promise, which came to be known as 40 acres and a mule, never came through as President Andrew Johnson rescinded the order after taking office. 2019 was a difficult time at American Safety Products. Although sales topped $1 million for the third consecutive year, no new contracts were signed. In that respect, 2020 has been better. Warren Arrington Jr. says the company he started 35 years ago is signing new projects this year, and there have been ample opportunities to bid for more. Construction, after all, is an essential industry, and his company is a first-tier subcontractor of Division 10 items, which entail finished goods such as fire extinguishers, cabinets, bathroom partitions, and other miscellaneous items that are installed toward the completion of a building. Over the decades, his business changed from serving large national accounts to focusing on smaller accounts. In the past, we had clients like Consolidated Diesel in Rocky Mount, Duke Health, and Denny's Restaurants. We were supplying gloves and disposable PPE even back then, Arrington says. Now everybody is looking for PPE and for Lysol, but as a micro company, we can't even get those from the manufacturers we used to get them from. It's challenging to be a micro company in this environment. But the challenge is for American Safety Products and other small minority business enterprises, or MBEs, existed long before the pandemic. Shifts in the marketplace and across industries left many MBE vendors on the sidelines. An increasing focus on computer-generated orders and diminished interaction between individuals was one disruptor. In some cases, large clients began ordering direct from manufacturers. In others, they outsourced purchasing to national facilities management companies, including Jones Lang LaSalle, or JLL, and C.B. Richard Ellis. Global companies inclined to choose enterprise-wide efficiencies over local hands-on service. Arrington recalls the contract his company had for 10 years with Merck Pharmaceuticals. But after Merck merged with Schering Plough in 2009, JLL was appointed to run Merck's global office facilities management, and that business vanished. The first thing JLL did was ask us to cut back, he says. The contract we had with Merck was labor-intensive service work. We had five people cleaning. I told JLL, how can we do that? You can't reduce people's salaries. We had done an excellent job for 10 years, but we didn't get rewarded for it. They went out for bid to get somebody who would do it for a lot less. The same kind of thing happened to us with Duke Health and Glaxo. We are a micro company competing in a large world, but I have been able to survive that world. He survived by making significant additions and changes along the way. When longtime client CP&L, now Duke Energy, said they needed a way to safely transport damaged transformers for repairs, Arrington invented an environmental kit that's been used for 28 years, not only by Duke Energy, but also by other utilities, including Georgia Power and New York State Electric. We have that business as a backdrop, and even before the pandemic, that business kept our doors open, he says. In 2004, the company added construction services with the Durham Performing Arts Center as its first big project. For almost 10 years, the company worked as a general trades and specialties contractor, but in 2013, it transitioned to the Division 10 category. In addition to public sector projects for the Wake County Public School System, universities, municipalities, and law enforcement, American Safety Products is now branching out into the private sector. Bridget Wall-Lennon, principal at B.L. Wall Consulting, has worked with Arrington for decades since she was charged with setting up the North Carolina Office of Historically Underutilized Businesses in 1999, where she worked for 14 years. Warren has done all of the things we tell MBE firms to do. Know your business, know your line of product, be involved. He's done all of those things over the years. He's had some successes and some dips, but he always worked hard at finding his niche, she says. Arrington stays focused on projects in the Triangle and recently took his company out of the running for a new dorm at UNC School of the Arts in Winston-Salem. Too far to travel, he says. But they are on track to finish a project at Chapel Hill High School within the month and will be starting a new parking deck project for the city of Durham. Ever since I've been in the business as a black-owned company, we have had to struggle to get people to pay attention, he says. But once you get the opportunity, it's all based on your performance and whether or not you're competitive in the marketplace. I would put American Safety Products up against anybody in the Division 10 area. We are competitive. Now, the organization that Arrington looks to most for project leads is the United Minority Contractors of North Carolina, UMCNC. Patrice Gilmore, who leads the nationwide supplier diversity program for DPR Construction, also serves as chair of the UMCNC Board of Directors, a post she's held for more than 5 years. From her vantage point at UMCNC, as well as her years in the construction industry, Gilmore says, in order for construction to be profitable and efficient, it needs to have a local emphasis. First and foremost, the priority is to find someone local who understands the market and materials. You will pay a premium if you bring subcontractors from other states. Across the industry, she also sees construction companies seeking to become more diverse and inclusive. That's where UMC would like all large construction companies to be, because it creates a dichotomy. If you only have diversity on projects where the clients ask for it, she says. For micro companies such as American Safety Products to succeed, large corporations are going to have to step up and engage their services. While Lennon asserts that it's more difficult for MBEs to get their foot in the door or to know who to speak with inside a large company. With the pandemic and the fallout of the Black Lives Matter movement, companies should be more mindful of working with minority and women-owned small businesses, she says. These businesses are hurting, and if the larger corporations would take a close look at these firms, it could help MBEs keep their doors open. On a private sector bid Arrington submitted recently, the outlook is strong. We got word this week that our numbers look good and they may be using us. It took persistence and staying on top of the general contractor, but we're probably going to get this detention center project. Every entrepreneur has to work to survive, and I'm in survival mode right now, he says. And we have two more shorter articles in the Promise Of section written by Caleb Harshberger. The first one, UMCNC Initiative pushed back to 2021. Like many of the best laid plans for 2020, the United Minority Contractors of North Carolina had to push one of its initiatives to 2021. Patrice Gilmore, chair for the board of directors at UMCNC, says they had negotiated an agreement with Procore, the developer of a cloud-based project management software widely used in the construction industry, to provide free access for a period of time to select UMC members. Sophisticated companies and utilizing software for documentation and project management, but many of our folks still use paper, Gilmore says. Especially with COVID-19, firms using technology were able to get in line for PPP, Payment Protection Program, loans. It was the folks recording in notebooks that could not get in line. Encouraging small minority businesses to embrace technology has been an emphasis at UMCNC for the last 2 years, but implementing the Procore option was disrupted by the pandemic. Procore was really generous in doing this with us, so we requested an extension to 2021 so members can start when things get back to normal, she explains. Tracking the unbanked and underbanked. The majority of U.S. adults, 77%, rely on traditional banks or credit unions, but 16% are underbanked and 6% are unbanked. The people in these two groups are more apt to have low incomes and be in a minority. Specifically, 14% of blacks and 11% of Latinx are unbanked, compared to only 4% of whites. An additional 35% of blacks are underbanked, compared to 23% of Latinx and 11% of whites. All this adds up to adverse outcomes on credit applications. Across all incomes, 45% of blacks were denied credit, compared to 18% of white applicants who were denied. Even if their incomes exceeded $100,000, 21% of blacks were denied the credit they requested. Only 8% of whites in that income bracket were denied credit. And now we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle Happenings, written by managing editor Dane Huffman. The first headline, Raleigh audio firm offers cool option for home theater. It's not quite the Jetsons just yet, but a Raleigh audio store that has been around since 1978 and made a big pivot to digital in recent years has a futuristic way to build out your home theater. Audio Advice has launched a software tool where a customer can input the dimensions of a room and the website will display a 3D view that walks them through how to set up the room, the speakers they need, and other ways to maximize the space. In a way, it's an extension of how the company started, when young founder Leon Shaw was looking to help people better understand audio in an era dominated by mall stores such as Sam Goody and The Record Bar. CEO Scott Newnam, has driven an effort to extend that expertise to the digital realm with an expanded website and team of people answering questions about products. But for years, he has wanted some way for customers to visualize the experience, and the company ramped up work on the project about a year ago. The timing with COVID could not have been better, Newman says. I've been like, get it out, get it out. Audio Advice, with a store on Glenwood Avenue and another in Charlotte, now gets about 60% of its business from customers out of state. The digital push has helped it grow to 67 employees and about $20 million in annual revenue. The new concept launched August 27. Essentially, customers can get a three-dimensional look at a home theater room and can change measurement options to fit it to their taste. So they can look at, say, a room that's 10 feet by 20 feet or one that's 12 by 18 and can get a sense of the experience from a chair in a front row or one in the back. The site automatically changes depending on the dimensions desired. They can sit in their house and literally build the room in real time, Newman says. He thinks the impact could be huge, especially as Americans are hanging out at the house and improving that time at home is part of life in the COVID era. We were ahead of the game, but it was just luck, he says. Goodbye to a classic in Cameron Village. The K&W Cafeteria has served its last plate of country fried steak and fruit congeal in Cameron Village. The K&W there was never Raleigh's finest restaurant and never tried to be. Instead, it was always a place where you grabbed your tray, slid it down the silver line, and sort of marveled at the long line of Southern-style food. It didn't matter if you were from Hayes, Barton, or Brentwood, or visiting the capital from points beyond. The K&W always had that welcoming ambiance. But pandemics are ruthless, Beast, and the longer it lasts, the more even iconic places are at risk. Investors plan a new bar in Raleigh's Glenwood South. Glenwood South could add another bar despite the tough times of the pandemic. In July, Raleigh's Centerline Properties filed site plans to transform its properties at 304 and 306 Glenwood Avenue into a new bar, an outdoor dining establishment. The parcels are currently leased to two local entrepreneurs, Dan Lovenheim, owner of the Cornerstone Tavern and Alchemy in Glenwood South, and Matt Kenner, who owns Milk Bar, Southern Chard, and Dogwood Bar and Eatery. The project calls for a 3,732-square-foot bar with an attached 3,644-square-foot outdoor dining deck on the site. The project is at the corner of Glenwood Avenue and West North Street next to the Rockford Restaurant. Centerline Properties bought 304 Glenwood for $1.15 million in 2014, and it bought 306 Glenwood for $1 million in 2015. Kenner and Lovenheim leased the property in 2018. It was previously the site of Devolve Moto and Vickers and Ruth Plumbing Company. Ashley Christensen teams up with Museum of Art. The North Carolina Museum of Art and Ashley Christensen Restaurants are teaming up on ACR at the Park, where the famed Raleigh chef will offer picnic food and beverage options for dining outside at the museum park or for takeaway dining at home. The concept launched in July as a pop-up experience with limited weekend hours, but is now open Thursday and Friday from 8 a.m. to 2 p.m. and Saturday and Sunday from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. You have to pre-order online. The museum's park's incredible works of art, rolling hills, and shaded nooks offer a one-of-a-kind setting for a picnic experience, said Museum Director Valerie Hillings. We're thrilled to pair this special landscape with the iconic Southern cuisine of Ashley Christensen Restaurants. The museum's galleries remain closed, but the park is open to visitors, and the museum says attendance has surged to nearly 100,000 visitors a month. Some deals are getting done in the Triangle. There is some good news on the commercial real estate front, with some deals getting closed despite the challenging times. CBRE Raleigh reports that its retail services group ended the second quarter with 32 transactions for a total of 187,157 square feet. For comparison, that team did 50 transactions for 198,931 square feet in the first quarter. The Triangle real estate market remains healthy with a retail vacancy rate of 7.0%, says Charlie Coyne, the head of CBRE Raleigh's Retail Services Group. Our Raleigh retail team continues to see improvement, and we are cautiously optimistic about the remainder of 2020 and 2021. And finally, in a section called He Said It, Michael Jordan, NBA star, speaking to shoe designer Jason Maiden. Maiden spoke August 25 at the Diversity, Equity, and Inclusivity Conference in Raleigh and told how he grew up in a rough part of Chicago and became a celebrated shoe designer at Nike. Jason, I can accept failure, but I can't accept not trying. And now we turn to the On Banking Transportation page written by Lauren Onasorge. American Airlines ending service to Greenville Airport. Bill Hopper, executive director at Pitt Greenville Airport, got the news the night before it broke in a press release. American Airlines will be suspending service to the small eastern North Carolina airport when its federal aid runs out in October. It's definitely something that we didn't want to hear, he says. We're a small commercial service airport. American Airlines is the only airline at this airport, so it's definitely going to impact air service in and out of this airport during that period. In all, airlines received $25 billion in federal aid through the CARES Act, and part of the requirement was that they had to maintain minimal levels of service through September 30. But since the spring, several airlines have requested to suspend service at airports across the country, including RDU, as the industry has been devastated by the pandemic. Altogether, American Airlines announced it is suspending service to 15 small U.S. cities in October. And, including Greenville, nine of those destinations are airports where it's the only airline providing scheduled commercial air service. Hopper hopes the situation will be temporary. According to American, the plan, for now, is to cut service from October 7 to November 3rd. The airline will continue to reassess plans for these and other markets as an extension of the payroll support program remains under deliberation, a release from the airline states. Airlines have been urging Congress to provide more federal aid. Hopper says his plan, at least right now, is to do everything we can to minimize the downtime and resume services as quickly as possible. Chapel Hill man pleads guilty to tax crimes. A Chapel Hill businessman has pleaded guilty to filing a false tax return in a case that, according to court documents, cost a tax loss of $800,000 to the Internal Revenue Service. Charles A.G. Atkins, who also faces a firearm possession charge, was charged August 18, records show. He controlled multiple risk consulting businesses, including financial engineering and risk management, risk assessment and management, and Ram Omni LLC, according to the filing, signed by Tanner Kroger, assistant United States attorney. And in 2015, according to prosecutors, he committed perjury on a tax form claiming income of just under $15,000 when he knew he had income in addition to that reported, they say. The government believes Atkins grossly underreported earnings from his businesses, causing a tax loss of more than $380,000 from 2011 through 2017. According to a release by the U.S. Department of Justice, it's believed he failed to pay more than $420,000 in taxes for several previous years. Atkins was previously convicted of tax fraud in 1988. Fayetteville site scores a big win despite pandemic. 7 years after a manufacturer left it vacant, a site in Fayetteville is getting a $27.7 million 118-job project, a big victory for economic developers amid the pandemic. Consumer goods manufacturer Danson's U.S. LLC of Phoenix is locating a new flagship distribution operation at the facility with plans to bring its wood pellet fuel, security products, grilling accessories, smokers, and pellet grills to retail partners such as Lowe's, Target, and Walmart. For economic developers, the pick, secured in just 3 months, was a long time coming. The old distribution center for women's underwear maker Maidenform had been vacant for 7 years, but prospects had toured the site before. Van manufacturer Morgan Olson came close in 2019, but put its 700 jobs in Virginia. Robert Van Gones, president and CEO of the Fayetteville-Cumberland Economic Development Corporation, didn't give up. Before the pandemic hit, his team was working on marketing materials from aerial shots to a video tour to up the site's visibility. With COVID-19 limiting travel, Scott Wadsworth, vice president of distribution and transportation at Danson, says those materials were vital. The company opted out of its usual process, which involved hopping a commercial jet. It chartered one instead, making multiple site visits and clinching the deal. The options narrowed to Georgia and North Carolina. The site itself sealed the win for Fayetteville, he says. The site has room to expand, which is huge for us, Wadsworth says. That's an absolutely key part of the decision. And along with this article, there's a big number, $41,900. The annual salary of jobs at Danson's U.S. LLC, the Cumberland County's average wage is just under $38,000. M&F Bank sees uptick from social justice campaigns. A heightened interest in social justice has been a boost to a historically black institution, M&F Bank in Durham. CEO James Sills says he attributes it to an increase in deposits from area businesses. Since the end of May through the first part of August, we've seen a significant increase in deposits, and it's primarily local deposits from local corporations, nonprofits, small and medium-sized businesses, he says. It really is because of all the social unrest, people wanting to partner with our bank and have a relationship with our bank. In the second quarter, the bank reported total deposits of $263.4 million, a hefty increase from the $236.5 million reported in the first quarter. We take those deposits and we redeploy them in the form of loans throughout North Carolina, Sills says. I think people finally get the message that banks like ours are close to urban communities and communities of color. We're really helping those communities by providing access to capital. According to the second quarter report, the bank provided loan modifications to 43% of its portfolio, from 90 days to 120 days. As of the end of July, the overwhelming majority of these loans have returned to normal payment structures. And finally, Paris flight back in 2021. Raleigh-Durham International Airport will see a key international flight return next year. The airport, which lost all of its international routes earlier this year amid the pandemic, will have its nonstop flight to Paris restored. Delta Airlines has confirmed plans to bring the flight back next summer, part of a much larger rollout across its network. At RDU, the Paris flight will be offered 5 times a week, according to the airline. The airline did not release other details of its plans for the RDU flight, although the Delta website shows the flight is available beginning March 27. In total, Delta plans to add more than 50 transoceanic flights across its network next summer, compared to this summer's travel schedule. And now we turn to the On Real Estate page, written by Caleb Harshberger. We work to close location in downtown Durham. Co-working giant WeWork plans to close one of its 2 locations in downtown Durham, vacating 3 floors of office space and clearing the way for the building's new owner's plans for the space. Tenants at WeWork's Durham.id location at 300 Morris Street received an email recently explaining that the company plans to close its location in the building at the end of the year. The message said that the decision comes after an in-depth review of the company's portfolio. The move comes less than 2 years after the company signed the lease for 74,184 square feet across 3 floors in Durham.id. In a separate email to Triangle Business Journal, August 26, the company said the review has been in the works since last fall and that the decision to leave Durham.id is not in response to the pandemic. WeWork also has space in One City Center in Durham and One Glenwood in downtown Raleigh. The company faced difficulties even before the pandemic. Last year, it scrapped plans for an initial public offering shortly after its founder, Adam Newman, stepped down. After the pandemic hit, WeWork chose to skip some of its rent payments and renegotiate its leases. Durham.id is made up of 2 large office buildings and an 8-story parking deck at 200 and 300 Morris Street in downtown Durham. The closure also cleared the way for Longfellow Real Estate Partners' recent purchase of the 300 Morris Street Tower, according to the seller, Bain Capital. California Group spends $590 million to expand footprint in RTP. A California firm has purchased a huge portion of a campus in Research Triangle Park in a deal that tops $590 million. On August 24, Alexandria Real Estate Equities closed on 253.11 acres at Palmer RTP for $590.4 million, according to Durham County deed records. The purchase by the Pasadena, California company includes 7 parcels across 3 deed transfers with properties at 14 TW Alexander Drive, 5 Moore Drive, 41 Moore Drive, 2 at 1818 Ellis Road, and 2 at 2400 Ellis Road. The seller, Los Angeles-based Carlin Real Estate, has been assembling land and developing the 500-acre campus for years. Joel Marcus, the founder and executive chairman of Alexandria, says the company is unable to comment on the purchase at this time. Alexandria has research campuses across the country, including an ag tech center in Research Triangle Park. Parmer RTP is among the largest assemblages in Research Triangle Park, featuring an R&D campus with 20 buildings and tenants such as LabCorp, Credit Suisse, and others. In December, Carlin paid $8 million for 101 acres to add to the campus. Before the sale, Carlin had acquired 2.5 million square feet of office and lab space and 650 acres of land in RTP since 2017, most notably the 1.75 million square foot Parmer RTP campus, formerly owned by GlaxoSmithKline. Carlin completed an $80 million overhaul of the campus. New York investor buys Raleigh apartments for $10 million. A garden-style apartment community in downtown Raleigh that dates to the 1980s changed hands recently after its owner sold the property to a New York investor. Austin, Texas-based Artesia sold the Capitol Flats and Magnolia Square apartment community August 24 in downtown Raleigh for $10.35 million, more than 30 years since the company purchased the property. The buyer on the deed is an LLC addressed to 555 Madison Avenue in New York City. The property is situated on 2 acres at 500 East Harget Street between the Lincoln Apartments and John Winters Park. The Capitol Flats and Magnolia Square apartments were built in 1982 and feature 85 units across a collection of three-story buildings. The property was renovated in January. Rents start at $1,050 a month for a one-bedroom unit, according to Apartments.com. The purchase joins a number of recent multifamily investments in the Triangle. Next door to Capitol Flats, Chicago multifamily investor Banner Apartments closed on the sale of the Lincoln Apartments last month, paying $48.75 million for the property 5 years after it opened. Highwoods to spice up retail plaza at Glen Lake Office Park. Highwoods is looking to bring a little flavor to its office plaza near Crabtree Valley Mall by adding retail and restaurant space. The Raleigh REIT, or REIT, filed plans earlier this month for a new retail plaza in the Glen Lake Office Park off Creedmoor Road. The plans call for a 5-tenant, single-story retail project at the Glen Lake 3 site, where Highwoods is also planning a new office building and parking deck. The retail project is situated on 4.75 acres at 4251 Park Lake Avenue. Filings with the city call for 13,219 square feet of retail space and room for 5 tenants. Elevations filed with the city show a collection of restaurants with space available for outdoor seating. Raleigh-based Piedmont Land Design is providing planning services on the project. The parcel will also be home to a 4-story parking deck and a planned office building. Last year, Highwoods filed plans for the Glen Lake Office Building 3, a 7-story building planned for the northern part of the parcel. And finally, Atlanta developer plans apartment project in Cary. An Atlanta developer has plans for a major apartment project in southeast Cary with hundreds of new units proposed and plans currently under review with the town. Rangewater Real Estate has filed plans for Jones Franklin Residential, a new multifamily project calling for 275 apartments across 3 buildings. The project is situated on about 9 acres at 2808 Macedonia Road, near a collection of retail centers south of the Interstate 40 and US 1 interchange. The project will also feature amenities such as 3 community gathering areas with a mix of different features. Area 1 will feature at least 8,000 square feet of space, a swimming pool, and at least one of the following options: fire pit, sports court, activity lawn, or outdoor kitchen. Area 2 will feature at least 2,000 square feet of space and include a dog park. Area 3 will include at least 1,500 square feet of space and feature a bench, paved area, or landscaping. Plans also call for road improvements as part of the project. And now we turn to On Healthcare and Higher Ed, written by Seth Thomas Gullidge. The first headline: empty campuses at UNC, NC State, and ECU bring serious risk to revenue. As North Carolina colleges retreat from holding in-person classes due to outbreaks of COVID-19, hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue are at stake if campuses once again become void of student activity. Recently, 3 of the University of North Carolina system's largest universities, UNC Chapel Hill, NC State, and East Carolina, each announced plans to end in-person classes for undergraduates. Now the universities are refunding housing contracts prorated for the little time students spent on campus and looking at another semester of mostly empty campus housing, cafeterias, and stores. Those ancillary services represent a vital source of revenue. In North Carolina, the biggest hit so far would come for UNC Chapel Hill, according to its reported auxiliary revenue for last year, which accounts for everything from housing and athletics to other campus-related services. The university has more than $886.8 million tied to auxiliary revenue, more than double the $438.4 million it collected in tuition, and a massive chunk of its total $3.4 billion in total revenue and support. Its expenses last year amounted to more than $3.1 billion. An analysis by the Business Journals determined a 50% decline in auxiliary sales would push UNC into a budget imbalance of roughly $216.5 million. If it were to disappear entirely, an unlikely scenario, the imbalance would be about $660 million. Those figures assume all other revenue and expense streams remain equal to last year's reported data, which is also an unlikely scenario. At NC State, the analysis shows a 100% reduction at the university would result in a budget imbalance of $85.5 million, while a 50% reduction would leave it at only $4.9 million in the black. At ECU, the analysis shows that even a 50% reduction in auxiliary revenue would result in a budget imbalance of $111.3 million. UNC Health approved for $22.4 million expansion. Hospital systems are working to keep up with projected future growth despite the pandemic, and UNC Health has received approval from state regulators for more than $22.4 million worth of expansions in Orange County. The North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services granted the hospital system approval for three new operating rooms in the county, which it applied for through the state's Certificate of Need process earlier this year. The expansion will cost UNC Health $10.4 million in total, according to the health system's application with the state. Duke partners with Asheville solar firm. Duke University is continuing its effort to become carbon neutral by 2024 by signing into a partnership with an Asheville-based solar developer for increased capacity at three new solar facilities planned for the state. Duke announced August 24 it had partnered with Pine Gate Renewables to build three new solar farms that are expected to be online by 2022 as part of Duke Energy's Green Source Advantage program. The university will buy 101 megawatts of solar capacity, which combined with other planned efforts will result in a 69% reduction in carbon emissions by 2022 and a 73% reduction by 2024 compared to its 2007 baseline. This partnership is a key step toward carbon neutrality, Duke President Vincent Price said. Duke is committed to building on our history of leadership in protecting the environment, a vitally important priority for our university and for humanity as we grapple with challenges of climate change. Duke Institute gets millions in funding. The Duke Human Vaccine Institute's Pandemic Prevention Program recently received an additional $7.6 million in federal funding to, quote, manufacture and test in humans a neutralized monoclonal antibody for the prevention of COVID-19, unquote, according to the university. The funding is earmarked from the Department of Defense's Defense Advanced Research Project Agency, which has already given the Institute millions in funding. The new funds will give the green light to Duke researchers led by Dr. Gregory Sempowski to initiate a phase one trial of highly potent antibodies that have been sourced from COVID-19 patients who have recovered from the virus. The team plans to manufacture a neutralizing antibody relying on RNA delivery beginning in late 2020. It plans to launch the trial with healthy volunteers in early 2021, and the university said enrollment is on target for that timeline. And the last article, Raleigh drug maker fights against delisting on NASDAQ. Not long after forming as part of a triple merger, one of the Triangle's newest drug makers is fighting to remain on the public markets. Raleigh-based 9Meters Biopharma was formed earlier this year from a merger between Raleigh's Innovate Biopharmaceuticals, Israel-based RDD Pharma, and California-based Naya Rare Diseases. John Temperato is president and CEO. The company recently disclosed to the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission that it received a listing determination letter from the NASDAQ Stock Market Listing Qualifications Department saying that it did not meet any of the initial listing requirements. The ruling stems from a previous notice that its stock had closed below the minimum $1 per share requirement for continued inclusion on the NASDAQ Capital Market, and that it had until August 17 to regain compliance. The company says it is appealing the decision and has requested a hearing scheduled for September 24. The request for a hearing, according to 9Meters, puts a hold on the delisting until the hearing process has concluded. And now we turn to the On Business page to read articles written by David Pertel. Report traces COVID outbreak to Boston meeting. The Biogen, Inc. leadership meeting in February may have led to more cases of COVID-19 than previously thought. According to a new report from dozens of scientists at the Broad Institute, Massachusetts General Hospital, and elsewhere, the event potentially caused as many as 20,000 coronavirus cases. The group studied hundreds of samples of the virus that causes COVID-19 collected at Massachusetts General Hospital's Clinical Microbiology Lab, according to an online post made in June by the co-lead author of the study, Jacob Lemieux. The meeting was also linked to several COVID-19 cases in Wake County in March. At least five patients identified in Wake County had traveled to Boston to attend the meeting. Biogen has a major presence in Research Triangle Park and employs 1,500 people in the region. At the time, the Biogen-linked cases in Wake County brought the total number of cases in North Carolina to 7. On March 10, the day after the Biogen cases were identified, Governor Roy Cooper declared a state of emergency, and North Carolina's top health official, Dr. Mandy Cohen, urged businesses to have their employees work remotely if possible. "We anticipate more positive test results from this Boston conference," Cooper said then. In the new report, by comparing microscopic differences between the virus samples, researchers identified 80 different strains of the virus that circulated among Massachusetts residents. Two outbreaks helped circulate a handful of the coronavirus strains, creating so-called super spreader events. The first super spreader event at the heart of the report was not identified beyond being an international conference, but details match the Biogen leadership meeting on February 26 and 27 held at the Boston Marriott Long Wharf. The Boston Business Journal contributed to this report. And another article, Raleigh among leaders in multifamily construction. The pandemic has put a ding in the real estate industry in the Triangle and across the country, but Raleigh still managed to be among the top cities in the nation in terms of new apartments completed in the first half of the year. Raleigh saw 1,161 apartments completed in the first 6 months of the year, according to a recent report from Rent Cafe. That was good enough for 19th best among the top 20 cities. Raleigh was ahead of Fort Myers, Florida, and behind Farmers Branch, Texas. Charlotte came in at number 4 on the list with 2,269 units completed. Austin, Texas led the way with 3,827 units. The Lone Star State had 5 cities in the top 20. New apartment projects continue to be announced in the Triangle, which has a high demand for housing. And now we turn to A Better World. And first we'll read the column written by Lori O'Keefe, who is the president and CEO of Triangle Community Foundation. The headline, Innovations Brighten a Changed World. A recent study of children in 3rd to 5th grade showed that in a normal year, students lost on average about 20% of their school year gains in reading and 27% of their school year gains in math during summer break. For the past 36 years, Triangle Community Foundation has offered a program to mitigate this loss called Send a Kid to Camp, focused on supporting children through fun and unique summer learning opportunities. In January, we awarded 13 local nonprofits grants of $10,000 each to continue this vital work. Then suddenly, the world was different. The past few months have been a whirlwind of constant changes in education and childcare, as many of us cope with balancing work and caring for children of all ages during the pandemic. I'm more appreciative than ever of the foundation's dedicated nonprofit partners and their endless capacity to adapt and adjust. This summer, we transitioned those summer camp grants to general operating support and chose to be flexible with that funding by telling our grantees we understood if summer programming couldn't occur. We gathered these nonprofit leaders virtually twice to check in, and instead of plans being canceled, we heard of so many creative new plans being made. The innovation we've seen has been truly inspiring, even more so because we know that nonprofit staffers are also juggling working from home and caring for their own families while they focus on meeting the community's growing needs. Seeds told us of sending boxes home with children to prepare them for virtual cooking classes and nutrition learning, even including the food, child-safe chopping knives and cutting boards. Triangle Bike Works pivoted from a bicycling trip focused on historical and conservation learning across four states to a virtual program open to the community. Juntos convened their usual summer program virtually instead of residentially and was still able to offer college access programming to 70-plus Latinx students. We're inspired and honored to be a part of this work, and it's informed our own as we think about our education and youth impact area and its grants this fall. Our community cannot succeed unless we focus on an equitable education for all students, especially during times such as these. Over the last year, we had chosen to focus on creating and enabling educated and empowered youth leaders with an additional focus on ensuring youth could complete their current educational track and, if desired, both access and complete college. But when the world changed, we realized it's hard to focus on the future when the present is so uncertain. And it seemed out of touch to proceed with our Send a Kid to Camp grant application cycle in August when no one can predict what summer 2021 might look like. Ultimately, we decided we needed to live in the present, and as so many of our nonprofit partners are being forced to do. Studies are suggesting that learning loss in reading will be upward of 30%, while math will have grown to 50% due to the pandemic and changes in educational opportunities over last spring and summer. To this end, our fall grant cycle is now focusing on flexible COVID relief for youth ages 5 to 24 facing learning loss, food insecurity, mental health, and technology access. As the fall progresses, I'm holding tight to the knowledge that we're not in this alone as a foundation and a nonprofit, but also as an individual and a parent. I know that we cannot move forward in isolation. Certainly, if we've learned nothing else in quarantine, it has been this. I'm grateful that we can be a partner in this work, even if only in a small way, and look forward to the bright spots to come. And now we turn to the nonprofit news. Raleigh's Art Space is now open by appointment. If you want to check out some of Raleigh's top artists, now you can. Art Space, the nonprofit that helps local artists showcase their work, is now open by appointment. Visitors can call 919-821-2787 to make an appointment, which should be at least a week before visiting. Appointments are available from Tuesday to Friday from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Tours can be self-guided or you can request a guided tour. The public can also reach out to individual artists to schedule a visit. Duke Energy gives grant to USO of North Carolina. The USO of North Carolina has been awarded a $20,000 grant from the Duke Energy Foundation to support service members and their families as they transition from the military to civilian life. The funds will help connect qualified service members and their spouses with positions in the energy and trade industries, as well as provide coaching. The USO's Pathfinder program is designed to help military families connect to the private sector with help on skills such as applying for positions, writing a resume, and interviewing. By partnering with the USO of North Carolina, we advance our goal of building a diverse workforce equipped to help the energy industry transform and innovate to meet customers' needs, said Stephen DeMay, Duke Energy's North Carolina president. Hungry Harvest looks for nominees for free produce. Hungry Harvest is looking to reward those helping the community by giving away $5,500 worth of produce. The nonprofit is looking for 25 people who will receive 3 months of produce delivered for free. The nonprofit will pick 5 winners from 5 targeted areas, which includes North Carolina. The winners can be frontline workers, food bank volunteers, and others who give back to the community in the pandemic. People can submit nominations on the Hungry Harvest website through September 8. Deliveries are expected to begin in the middle of September. Durham Tech to provide short-term courses to combat unemployment. Durham Technical Community College is launching its Back to Work initiative to provide short courses with the aim of getting people qualified to find employment in high-demand industries. According to the college, the program was launched in response to unprecedented unemployment across the Triangle due to COVID-19. The program creates quick access for those who are unemployed or underemployed to jobs that are hiring right now, Durham Tech Interim President Tom Jane said. These courses also map to higher-level credentials and living wages through guided career pathways. Durham Tech understands the importance of aligning short-term and common courses to reduce the potential credit loss when students continue their education. Back to Work puts what we've learned into action, they say. Courses will focus on high-demand occupations, including health, biotechnology, skilled trades, and information technology. And finally, WGUNC announces scholarship program. WGU North Carolina, a branch of the online Western Governors University, has announced a new online access scholarship program that will provide high-speed internet access and devices for WGU students who can't afford them. The program, run nationally across WGU branches, is a $1 million part of a broader initiative by the university aimed at, quote, closing the digital divide by providing more Americans access to reliable internet in their homes, unquote. And now we turn to the viewpoint page in the Triangle Business Journal to read the editor's notebook written by Sugata Mukherjee, editor-in-chief of the Triangle Business Journal. The headline, Why Congress May Be Balking at Forgiving Certain PPP Loans. On August 24, Senator James Lankford of Oklahoma joined North Dakota Senator Kevin Cramer to introduce a bill that will automatically forgive Paycheck Protection Program, or PPP, loans of $150,000 and under for small businesses. That covers about 4.2 million of the 5.2 million loans under the giant $660 billion program. But on the same day, news broke that prominent religious leader Jim Baker's Morningside USA ministry in Missouri received PPP approval for an amount between $650,000 and $1.7 million. But just weeks before, the Missouri Attorney General filed a complaint saying the Jim Baker Show had engaged in deceptive practices, suggesting a health product touted on the show has the ability to prevent COVID-19 infection. Soon after, the Food and Drug Administration, the Federal Trade Commission, and the New York Attorney General's office issued warning and cease and desist letters to Morningside. And therein lies the problem with the forgiveness bill. While most agree that the loan program was helpful to millions of small businesses, the forgiveness process baked into the program continues to be confusing and cumbersome. Many Capitol Hill watchers believe the Small Business Administration leaders are worried that a blanket forgiveness may release too many bad actors from being held accountable for their actions. Almost daily, there are news accounts across the country of people buying luxury boats, cars, and even houses with the PPP proceeds, while millions of other businesses struggle to keep their doors open. So the concern of having some blanket rule of forgiveness is legitimate and real, but there is a hybrid option. Why not forgive the $150,000 and under loans completely and set up a system to review every loan of more than $1.5 million? Such an action will cover more than 80% of the loans and almost 80% of the money. Trying to find bad actors from small businesses that employ less than 10 people simply is not a good use of government resources. Say you find 100,000 businesses with an average of $75,000 in loans that should not have received the money. What will the SBA do? Ask them to return it? Put the owners in jail? A loan repayment plan? They can do all that, but we're talking about $7.5 billion out of the already disbursed $525 billion, a 1.5% penetration rate. Now, let's assume among the 100,000 businesses that received more than $1 million, a review determines 5,000 PPP loans should not have been eligible for the program. At an average of $1.5 million, that's the same $7.5 billion in potential recovery. The big difference is auditing 4 million plus small businesses versus 100,000 businesses. If the lawmakers in Washington want to pass a bill to bring some regulatory relief for small businesses, the $150,000 forgiveness clause needs to be attached to the $1.5 million automatic audit clause. Businesses that receive millions may not like that, but they have accountants, financial officers, and outside counsel to get their paperwork together come audit time. If they spent the money correctly, they won't have to worry about a thing. A dual attack that addresses forgiveness and automatic audits would provide cover for the SBA, lenders, and most small businesses. Or we can just get tangled in the politics of it all and watch more businesses go out of business. And with the rest of our time, we'll read as much as we can of the executive voice featuring Jill Monroe. The headline, Changing the Game for Women in Tech. This is written by Lauren Onasorge. Ask Jill Monroe and she'll tell you a lifetime of working at major companies from JP Morgan Chase to Fidelity has prepared her for her most exciting challenge yet, leading technology for up-and-coming startup Spreedly. And she'll also tell you that she and women like her have a responsibility to bring the next generation of female technology leaders to the table. Monroe was born in Toronto, moving as a teenager to just outside New York City. When she was a kid, she wanted to be a zoologist and enjoyed her summers as a lifeguard. But Monroe's life would soon take a different turn as she was drawn to accounting at Bucknell University. Graduate school brought her to Washington, D.C., albeit for a very different line of work. Her master's degree was in East Asian Studies. I spent a lot of time at think tanks, she says. After Monroe graduated, she had to get serious about her future, and her father's career as a management consultant influenced her trajectory. Monroe decided to broaden her horizons and enter the private sector. It was the variety, as well as the impact, that helped guide her toward bigger companies. The space I was in East Asian Studies, it was very small, very focused area, she says. The audience for what I was doing was certainly very small. And we'll stop there as the story continues about her rise in business and finance and technology and how there were very few women at the time, and now she feels a need to bring more women into the fold. And we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Triangle Business Journal is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Today's program is generously underwritten by Brian Lee Funeral Homes, located in Raleigh, Garner, and Anger. They can be reached at 919-832-8225. They believe every life is unique and deserves to be honored so that every funeral is as unique and special as the person it represents. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time, and thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.